Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Oh, I don't have my pages open. I always do that, don't I? Project Tolstoy, secret codename Project Tolstoy, is about 90% complete. 90%, I'm going to say, well, to be more precise, it's 24/28 complete. 24 out of 28 bits of it, chapters, you could say, are complete. So it's really soon. It's coming soon. Less than a week, I would say. Now, I can't expect you to be too excited because you have got no idea what that is. But still, it's exciting. Trust me. At least I'm excited. Part 1, Chapter 9 of Anna Karenina. That's what we're here to talk about today, though. What did you think of Kitty? What a lovely setting for a chapter. What are your thoughts on the setting and general discussion? I am Norwegian, said man, with Levin walking up, palms sweaty, knees weak, arms heavy, is growing more and more relatable. Oh, thank you, she added when he picked up the handkerchief, which had fallen out of her muff. Excuse me, says Norwegian. Ouch. Sorry. And then looked at him with a smile of quiet affection, as if he were a favourite brother. Ouch. I prematurely ouched then. Yeah, that whole looking at him like a brother, he got, what do they call it, friend-zoned. Pretty good, I think, in this chapter. Yeah, and the repeated use of the word muff, yeah, I noticed it too. I think it may have meant muffler or something like that, like a scarf. I really enjoyed this chapter, says I am Norwegian. The picture it painted was more vivid than previous ones. Complex social dynamics explained so simply is also impressive. We still don't really know Levin, yet he feels so relatable. The description of Kitty made me feel like maybe Levin's conception of her wasn't so far off after all. One thing I didn't realize when we read War and Peace, and I'd been reading it for a good 8 months or 9 months. We were a fair way through the book. And I started to watch the BBC series of it. And War and Peace was the first book I read in that sort of Russian 1800s high society setting. Yeah, so I was a good 8 months into the book, probably more. And I watched the series, and it was only when I watched the series that I realized how grandiose these mansions were that the book was set in. And they talk about, the characters going from one part of the mansion to another, to their apartments. And they would have whole wings of the mansion, which are bigger than mansions we have now. Like, these were huge. They were like palaces. I did not realize this reading the book until I watched the show and just saw how huge all of these places really are. They're big enough for, like, I don't know, they're like, what do they call them? Homesteads, more. They're bigger than homesteads. They're massive. Yeah, so I didn't realize how, like, I knew it was fancy. I knew it was high society. I guess I just didn't realize how fancy. We don't have that kind of fancy these days. Like, no one has that kind of fanciness these days. It's like, you know how you think of, like, the White House? Now, I don't think the president actually lives in the White House. Maybe they do. I don't really know. No, they don't do that. It's just where their office is. I actually don't know, now that I think about it. But, like, the White House is a facility big enough for hundreds of people. You know, it's huge. That was what their houses were like. Like, literally hundreds of people could live on these premises. What am I trying to say? What did I bring that up? Oh, yeah, the reason I brought that up is because Tolstoy doesn't do a setting very well. I read eight chapters of the book without picturing anything like that. And it wasn't until I watched the show and saw the settings that I got it into my head. Oh, wow, that's what I'm meant to be imagining. I didn't even get close. And I realized in the whole book, there are very few settings which felt like I could vividly imagine them. Or some that I couldn't even really imagine at all. I just had no idea what to imagine. Tolstoy, yeah, he's not a good settings guy. And even in this chapter, it was a very nice setting. It was. He did a good job in this one. I'm not saying he never does a good setting, but still it wasn't... I think the reason it stood out as a good setting is because we're 9 chapters in, and this is really maybe the first chapter where I can imagine where they are. Yeah, so I don't know. That's just an observation I've had about Tolstoy. I wonder if anyone else shares that opinion. Sluggy, with 3 G's, said, I think this is one of the most beautiful chapters in the book. The mentioning of the birch trees at the beginning of the chapter is significant. Birch trees are an important cultural symbol in Russia and are poetic symbols of femininity, spring and purity. In the same way, Kitty represents all these things to Levin. You have to feel for Levin, and Kitty so quickly rebuffs him. He has been living in this dream world where he loves Kitty and is going to marry her, but that is quickly shattered when he has to face reality. I think many of us have been here before and had strong feelings for someone who didn't necessarily return them, and this just makes Levin that much more relatable. Thank you for that, by the way, Sluggy. I love it when the little symbolism in a chapter is pointed out, like the thing about the birch and what it represents. That's really cool. Soma Stars says, I like Kitty. So far she seems like a normal, healthy, confident girl. I get the impression she cares for him, just not romantically, and she handles it well. She picks up on his cues and tactfully tries to dodge them while maintaining the friendship. I like Levin, but I feel a bit for him. I don't know if he's a bit clueless to her cues or if he just feels like he needs to be super direct with her in order to get a very direct answer from her. But either way, I feel like he's going to get rejected and won't have a thick enough skin for it. Archineering said, she reacts normally to a semi-close acquaintance who she's seeing for the first time in a while. Levin was being very romantic in his hope that she would be head over heels in love upon seeing him again, though I sympathize with him. He lacks patience and some maturity. J-Mama says, and she hears his statements about depending on her and thinks, oh shit. Lol, come on, Levin, get it together, man. Little Birdie 8612 said, I love this chapter and the setting too. There's such a sense of freshness to it. I remember reading it 2 years ago when school was hard and my mum let me stay home sometimes. Then I would spend my winter mornings outside reading Anna Karenina, and I remember how the cool briskness of the air mixed with the hot February sunshine and how it matched the atmosphere in this skating rink scene. You know, Little Birdie, reading that and learning that, 2 years ago you were in school. You must be quite young. I'm really surprised because your comments that you make are so mature and so well thought out. You must be very, very clever. Micro Coyote. I like your username. Welcome to the podcast. My favorite line of the book so far is in this chapter. He walked down for a long while, avoiding looking at her as at the sun, but seeing her as one does the sun without looking. This is the most romantic description of a hopelessly love-struck person I think I've ever seen. I love the picture it evokes. Did anyone else notice this part? I know I don't have the translation people like. How did y'alls phrase it? That was from Garnet, that translation. Yeah, that line did strike me. Yeah, it did. Like, how you look at the sun without looking. Because I was like, oh, that's a funny thing to say, because it's like just light that's in the air, in the world. Sluggy said, In my translation, it reads, "He walked down, trying to avoid looking at her for too long, as if she were the sun, but like the sun, he could still see her even when he was not looking at her." I think it was better in the Garnet translation. The first one, that Micro Coyote said. Swim said the mama fishy said, "As a young woman, lo, many years ago, I was very dismissive of Levin," which appears to be where Kitty is heading. Gunadal says, "Hey, Gunadal, haven't seen you around for a while. Does anyone else inadvertently picture movie characters when reading? The description of Levin skating, the descriptions of his appearance and his awkwardness around girls reminded me of Sean William Scott in Goon." Oh man, I didn't have that picture in my head, but thank you for that and for bringing up that one of my favourite little games to play as we enter into a new book. The game of, if this book was a movie, who would play these characters? Spin the wheel. Who's up next? Thermos of Burr. "I've always had a hard time picturing characters from the descriptions in books," says Thermos of Beer, which made me think of the drawing of an elephant made from a description of it in Italy in 1440. "But I don't think I'm nearly as good at coming up with a picture of something as whoever drew the elephant. So I like your comparison. It gives me a good reference to a character I know. But I'm glad Levin actually knows how to skate." It would have been worse if he was as bad as SWS Sean William Scott in Goon. "I am Norwegian," said, "I'm terrible at coming up with faces for characters. It tends to be shapes with me, or cartoon caricatures, described feature, or fragments of the character. Sometimes I will look up fan art or actors from adaptations to help me along." Well, no one really played the game, but, and you know what? I don't have a clear enough picture of these characters yet to play the game either. Give me maybe a few more chapters, once we get to know these characters a bit better. This Levin guy. Okay, so he's fawning over a girl's unrequited love and he's too enthusiastic about it. Reminds me of Aziz Ansari. He seems to be like that in his show. Oh, sorry. When I read that comment before by Thermos of Beer, where he mentioned the drawing of an elephant made from a description of it in Italy, I opened the image in a new tab and I just tabbed over to that and saw it, and it's hilarious. It looks like a what does it look like? An aardvark with tusks and a long trunk. It's hairy, and that's quite funny. That's really funny. What an idiot. Whoever drew that had never seen an elephant. Yula is a pimp, said, "The setting really is wonderful. The birch trees, I'm picturing white birch, though I'm not sure exactly what would be in Russia. I was imagining silver, but, you know, I'm just a romantic. Covered in snow, standing guard around a frozen lake. I have a clear Bob Ross-like picture in my head, even though Tolstoy doesn't describe it in much detail. I enjoyed how competitive Levin immediately became when another dude showed up and started skating well. It's silly, of course, but immediately relatable for any guy who has ever courted a girl. And it's romantic because of the sort of childlike innocence of which meshes well with the setting being unadulterated and covered in snow." Mofosta87 says, "I think the setting plays into it. As well as influences our initial impression of Kitty. This is a romanticized, picture-perfect makeup scene for a love story. I also think we are influenced by how Levin thinks of Kitty. However, there is this moment where I think she has no interest in Levin, but entertains the idea of settling for him. I know it's not he that I love, but I am happy with him. And he's so nice. This is the statement of weak character. Then again, Levin is settling for Kitty himself. Perhaps they're meant for each other. All I can say is these characters need to develop some autonomy. Or perhaps it's a cultural thing of the times. But I don't think that's the case." Dr. Nature 96 says, "Hey, does anyone have a digital copy of Maud's translation that is readable on the phone?" P. Calvin said, "I'm reading the one from Amazon. I think it was $3. Yeah, I think the Maud one you can't get for free. I think you've got to get the Kindle copy for $3. Unforch. It's just the unforch situation. All right. Oh, man, I'm struggling to breathe tonight. It's because I ate these banana cake things, and they've seemed to have been lodged in my heart cavities, in my arteries. I bought these banana, I thought they were banana muffin bars, not exactly healthy, but I'm like, yeah, as a little treat, little muffin bars, and banana muffin bars, a little box of them. I think there was 10 in the box, and I'm like, that'll last me for a little while. You know, just something on the go when you got to go drive somewhere in the car and you need a little snack on the go or to pack a lunch or, you know, whatever. Anyway, it turned out they were banana cake bars, not banana muffin bars, which the difference being a ton of sugar. So I got these 10 extremely sugary banana bread cake things, which I feel obliged to eat because I bought them. Anyway, I just ate one right before I did the podcast, and they seem to slow down my heart as I eat them. It's seriously disgustingly, disgustingly sweet. So I've made myself a green tea. This podcast today is brought to you by the beverage green tea, which is hopefully going to melt down some of that sugar and help me breathe again. I'm sure that that's not how the body actually works, but whatever. Anyway, that's the end of the conversation. What should I do? I should remind you guys about the Patreon page, please. If you would like to, you can support the podcast via Patreon, patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. Your support is very much appreciated. Otherwise, continue listening for free. I'm happy with that too. All right, this is chapter 10 of, what are we reading? Anna Karenina. When they entered the restaurant, Levin could not help noticing something peculiar in his friend's expression. A kind of suppressed radiance in his face and whole figure. Oblonsky took off his overcoat and, with his hat on one side, walked into the dining room, giving his orders to the Tatar waiters in their swallowtail coats with napkins under their arms, who attached themselves to him, bowing right and left to his acquaintances who, here as elsewhere, greeted him joyfully. He passed on to the buffet, drank a glass of vodka, and ate a bit of fish as hors d'oeuvres, and said something to the painted Frenchwoman, bedecked with ribbons and lace, who sat at a little counter, something that made even this Frenchwoman burst into frank laughter. Levin did not take any vodka, simply because that Frenchwoman, made up, as it seemed to be, of false hair powder and toilet vinegar, was offensive to him. He moved away from her as from some dirty place. His whole soul was filled with Kitty's image, and his eyes shone with a smile of triumph and happiness. "This way, please, Your Excellency, this way. No one will disturb Your Excellency here," said a specially officious waiter, an old white-headed Tartar, so wide in the hips that the tails of his coat separated behind. "If you please, Your Excellency," he said, turning to Levin, and as a mark of respect to Oblonsky, paying attention to his guest, in a moment he had spread a fresh cloth on a round table, already covered with a cloth beneath a bronze chandelier, moved two velvet chairs to the table, and stood with a napkin and menu awaiting the order. "If Your Excellency would like a private room, one will be vacant in a few moments. Prince Golitsyn is there with a lady. We've some fresh oysters in, sir. Oh, oysters, Oblonsky paused and considered. Shall we change our plan, Levin? He said, with his finger on the bill of fare and his face expressing serious perplexity. But are the oysters really good? Now, be careful. Real Flensburg, Your Excellency, with no Ostend ones. They may be Flensburg, but are they fresh? They only arrived yesterday. Well, then, shall we begin with oysters and change the plan of our dinner? Eh? I don't mind. I like buckwheat porridge and cabbage soup best, but they don't have those things here. Would you like a buckwheat à la Russe? Said the Tartar, stooping over Levin like a nurse over a child. No, joking apart, whatever you choose will suit me. I've been skating and I'm hungry. Don't think that I do not appreciate your choice, he added, noticing a dissatisfied look on Oblonsky's face. I shall be glad of a good dinner. I should think so. Say what you like, it is one of the pleasures of life, said Oblonsky. Well then, my good fellow, bring us two, or that will be too little. 3 dozen oysters and vegetable soup. Printanière, chimed in the waiter. But Oblonsky evidently did not wish to give him the pleasure of calling the dishes by their French names. Vegetable, you know, the turbot with thick sauce, and then roast beef, and mind it's good, and then capon, shall we say, yes, and stewed fruit. The waiter, remembering Oblonsky's way of calling the items on the French menu by their Russian names, did not repeat the words after him, but afterwards allowed himself the pleasure of repeating the whole of the order according to the menu. Potage, printanière, turbot, sauce bouchamarachis, poulard à l'estragon, macédoine de fruits. And immediately, as if moved by springs, he put down the bill of fare in one cardboard cover, and seizing another, containing the wine list, held it out to Oblonsky. What shall we have to drink? Whatever you like, only not too much. Champagne, said Levin. What, to begin with, however, why not? You like the white seal? Cachet Blanc, chimed in the waiter. Yes, bring us that with the oysters, and then we'll see. Yes, sir. And what sort of table wine? Nuit. No, let's have the classic. Chablis. Yes, sir. And your special cheese? Well, yes, Parmesan. Or do you prefer some other kind? No, I really don't care, said Levin, unable to restrain a smile. The Tartar darted off, his coat tails flying, and 5 minutes later rushed in again with a dish of opened oysters in pearly shells and a bottle between his fingers. Oblonsky crumpled his starched napkin and pushed a corner of it inside his waistcoat, then with his arms comfortably on the table, attacked the oysters. Not bad, he said, pulling the quivering oysters out of their pearly shells with a silver fork and swallowing one after another. Not bad, he repeated, lifting his moist and glittering eyes now to Levin and now to Tartar. Levin could eat oysters, though he preferred bread and cheese, but it gave him more pleasure to watch Oblonsky. Even the Tartar, who was having drawn a cork and poured the sparkling wine into the thin, wide glasses, was straightening his white tie, glanced off with a smile of evident pleasure at Oblonsky. You don't care much for oysters, said Oblonsky, emptying his champagne glass. Or perhaps you're thinking of something else, eh? He wanted Levin to be in good spirits, but Levin, if not exactly in bad spirits, felt constrained. The feelings that filled his heart made him ill at ease and comfortable in this and uncomfortable in this restaurant, with its private rooms where men took women to dine. Everything seemed offensive. These bronzes, mirrors, gaslights, and Tartar waiters. He was afraid of soiling that which filled his soul. I am preoccupied, and besides, all this makes me feel constrained, he said. You can't imagine how strange it all seems to me, who live in the country. Like the nails of that gentleman I saw at your place. Yes, I noticed that poor Grinvich's nails interested you greatly, said Oblonsky. I can't help it, replied Levin. Put yourself in my place. Look at it from a country fellow's point of view. We try to get our hands into a state convenient to work with, and for that purpose we cut our nails and sometimes roll up our sleeves, but here people purposely let their nails grow until they begin to curl, and have little saucers for studs to make it quite impossible for them to use their hands. Oblonsky smiled merrily. Yes, it is a sign that rough work is unnecessary to him. He works with his mind. Possibly. But still, it seems to me strange that while we country people try to get over our meals as quickly as we can, so as to be able to get on with our work, here, you and I try to make our meal last as long as possible, and therefore eat oysters. Well, of course, said Oblonsky. The aim of civilization is to enable us to get enjoyment out of everything. Well, if that's the aim, I'd rather be a savage. You are a savage as it is. All you Levins are savages. Levin sighed. He remembered his brother Nicholas and frowned, feeling ashamed and distressed, but Oblonsky started a subject which at once distracted his thoughts. Well, are you going to see our people tonight? The Sherbatskys, I mean, he said, pushing away the rough and now empty oyster shells and drawing the cheese towards him, while his eyes glittered significantly. Yes, certainly I shall go, though the princess appeared to ask me rather unwillingly. Not a bit of it. What humbug. It's just her manner. Come, bring us that soup, my good fellow. It's her grande dame manner, said Oblonsky. I shall come too, but I must first go to a musical rehearsal at the Countess Bonin's. What a strange fellow you are, though. How did you explain your sudden departure from Moscow? The Shabatskys asked me again and again, but as if I ought to know all about you. Yet all I know is that you never do things as anyone else does. Yes, said Levin slowly and with agitation. You are right, I am a savage, only my savagery lies not in having gone away, but rather in having come back. I have now come. Oh, what a lucky fellow you are, interrupted Oblonsky, looking straight into his eyes. Why? Fiery steeds buy something, brands. I can always recognize youths in love at once, I know, by the look that lights their eyes. Declaimed Oblonsky. You have everything before you. And you? Have you everything behind you? No, not behind me, but you have the future and I have the present. And even that, only half and half. Why? Things are rather bad. However, I don't want to talk about myself, and besides, it's impossible to explain everything, said Oblonsky. Well, and why have you come to Moscow? Here, take this away, he shouted to the Tatar. Don't you guess, answered Levin, the light shining deep in his eyes as he gazed steadily at Oblonsky. I do, but I can't begin to speak about it. By which you can judge whether my guess is right or wrong, said Oblonsky, looking at him with a subtle smile. Well, and what do you say to it? Asked Levin, with a trembling voice, feeling that all the muscles of his face were quivering. What do you think of it? Oblonsky slowly drank his glass of Chablis, his eyes fixed on Levin. There is nothing I should like better, said he. Nothing. It is the best that could happen. But are you not making a mistake? Do you know what we are talking about? Said Levin, peering into his interlocutor's face. Interlocutor's face. You think it possible? I think so. Why shouldn't it be? No, do you really think it's possible? No, you must tell me all you really think. And suppose a refusal was in store for me. I am even certain. Why do you think so? Said Oblonsky, smiling at Levin's excitement. Well, sometimes it seems to me, you know, that would be terrible, both for her and for me. That would be terrible, both for her and for me. Oh, no. In any case, there's nothing in it terrible for the girl. Every girl is proud of an offer. Yes, every girl, but not she. Oblonsky smiled. He understood that feeling of Levin's so well, knew that for Levin, all the girls in the world were divided into two classes. One class included all the girls in the world, except her. And they had all the usual human failings and were very ordinary girls, while the other class, herself alone, had no weaknesses and was superior to all humanity. Wait a bit, you must take some sauce, said Oblonsky, stopping Levin's hand that was pushing away the sauce boat. Levin obediently helped himself to sauce, but would not let Oblonsky eat. No, wait, he said. Understand that for me, it is a question of life and death. I have never spoken to anyone about it, and can speak to no one else about it. Now you and I are quite different in everything, in tastes and views and everything. But I know you like me and understand me, and so I am awfully fond of you. But for God's sake, be quiet. Be quite frank with me. I am telling you what I think, said Oblonsky, smiling. And I tell you something more. My wife is a most wonderful woman, he sighed, remembering his relations with his wife. Then after a minute's pause, he continued, she has the gift of clairvoyance. She sees people through and through. But more than that, she knows what is going to happen, especially in regard to marriages. For instance, she predicted that the Shakovskaya girl would marry Prentelne. No one would believe it, but as it turned out, she was right, and she is on your side. How do you know? In this way, she not only likes you, but says that Kitty is sure to be your wife. At these words, a sudden smile brightened Levin's face, the kind of smile that is not far from tears of tenderness. She says that, he cried. I have always thought her a jewel, your wife, but enough about it, and he got up. All right, but sit down. But Levin could not sit still. He strode up and down the little cage of a room, blinking to force back his tears, and only when he had succeeded did he sit down again. Try and realize, he said, that this is not love. I have been in love, but this is not the same thing. It is not my feeling, but some external power that has seized me. I went away, you know, because I had come to the conclusion that it was impossible, you understand, because such happiness does not exist on earth. But I have struggled with myself and found that without that, there's no life for me, and it must be decided. Then why did you go away? Wait a moment. Oh, what a crowd of ideas. How many things I have to ask. Listen, you can't imagine what you have done for me by saying what you did. I'm so happy that I'm acting meanly. I've forgotten everything. I heard today about my brother Nicholas. He's here, you know. And I forgot all about him. It seems to me as if he too were happy. Is it like madness? It is like madness. But there is one awful thing about it. You, who are married, know the feeling. It is awful that we, who are comparatively old and have pasts, not of love, but of sin, suddenly we come into close intimacy with a pure, innocent being. That is disgusting, and therefore one can't help feeling oneself unworthy. Well, there haven't been many sins in your past. Ah, but all the same, said Levin, looking back at my life, I tremble and curse and bitterly regret. Yes, what's to be done? That's the way the world is made, said Oblonsky. My only consolation is that prayer that I like so much. Not according to my deserts, but according to thy mercy. And she, too, can only forgive me that way. All righty. Another chapter down. Very, very good. I'm liking this book more and more as we read. This is good. This is a good thing. I liked it from the start. I had a little dip when things skipped along a little bit too quickly for my pace. And now, you know, I'm a sucker for romance. What can I say? Well, as soon as it's a boy and a girl, will they, won't they? I'm like, ooh, are they going to do it? And I'm a sucker. What can I say? I don't know why. I don't know how I got to be that way. I've always thought romance stories were like the lamest type of story. But here we are. I'm a sucker for romance. There you go. You got me. Have your say about this chapter over at reddit.com/r/theHemingwayList. Thank you very much for listening today. I'll see you tomorrow.